First up today, two folks who are presenters at this weekend's TEDxKC gathering of speakers presenting cutting-edge ideas. We'll talk to a do-it-yourself musician in just a little bit. And right now, we'll talk to Professor Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School. He's focusing his considerable attention on the corrupting influence of money in American politics. Professor Lessig says we can't begin to deal with climate change, financial reform, education, or anything until we deal with this. He's the author of Lesterland, The Corruption of Congress and How to End It. And Professor Lessig, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, most people get that we have a huge, huge issue when it comes to the corrupting influence of money. What they don't get, and what I struggle with, you know, after too many years of life, of my life covering this stuff, is not only what to do about it, but is there anything at all that Congress will do to deal with this? In other words, you know, people have given up hope that anything can be done. What about that?
That's a great point. We did a poll last year, and we found 96% of Americans believe it important to reduce the influence of money in politics. You kind of wonder who's the 4%, but if you think about the number of lobbyists in Washington, maybe that's the 4%. But then we also found in the same poll that 91% of Americans didn't think there was anything you could do about it. Now, you know, with due respect to the 91%, that's just not true. We can absolutely change the corrupting influence of money in politics, and we don't even have to change the Constitution to be able to do it. What we have to do is to pass a statute that would change the way elections are funded, and the Supreme Court has again and again indicated that such statutes are constitutional. So the really important thing is to make people aware that change is possible. Change even without amending the Constitution is possible, and then to get them to begin to demand that their members of Congress take up the commitment to make that change.
Well, you would change the law then, Professor, to do what exactly?
Well, right now, the problem with the way money infects politics is that members spend anywhere between 30 and 80% of their time raising money from the tiniest fraction of the 1%. I calculated the number of relevant funders of campaigns, meaning people who give enough to really matter to how a candidate thinks about things, as no more than 150,000 Americans. Huh. Well, when you have them spending all of their time worrying about what 150,000 Americans want, there's no surprise that we have a government that's responsive to funders and not responsive to the vast majority of Americans. So the way to fix that is just to make it so that when they raise their money, they're not raising their money in large chunks from 150,000 Americans. They're instead raising money from the broad swath of Americans in small dollar contributions. And there are two ways to do this. One is a Republican idea for small dollar public funding, which would be like vouchers, where you give everybody a voucher, and with their voucher, they then can contribute the voucher to candidates who agree to fund their campaigns with small contributions only. The Democratic idea is matching grants. John Sarbanes has a bill called the Government by the People Act, where small contributions can be matched up to 9 to 1. So $100 could be worth $1,000 to a campaign. But both of these solutions would change the business model of fundraising. So candidates are focused on what all of us care about, and not what just the tiniest fraction of the 1% care about.
And Professor Lessig, I know you've heard this a million times, but the Republican Congress particularly isn't inclined to go along with anything remotely like what you're talking about.
Right now, that's right. But that's not because Republicanism should oppose this reform. It's because the particular Republicans inside the Beltway are now convinced that the only way they can win is if their party can take directly and indirectly extraordinarily large contributions. But I think this just means we need Republicans outside the Beltway to begin to step up and to tell the party they don't want the Republican Party to be the party of corruption. They want the Republican Party to embrace the values that have long defined the party of, you know, Democratic support for Democratic policy change. And remember important facts like this. The number one beneficiary of public funding of presidential campaigns was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan ran three national campaigns on the public fisc using public funding. He never would have been elected president without public funding because his 76 campaign was only possible because public funding was there. The Republican Party was not about to give him the money necessary to take on Gerald Ford. And the really important thing to think about is when he ran for re-election in 1984, He attended a total of 8 fundraisers.
Wow.
When Barack Obama ran for re-election in 2012, he attended 228 fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
So public funding made it possible for the president to govern as opposed to fundraise. And that's the idea we need to revive, not just for Republicans, but for Democrats both.
Yeah, Professor, why do you think that your notion of small dollar donations here, why wouldn't you then, if you implemented that, why wouldn't you be creating a system where politicians would be spending even more time raising money to come close to the amount of money they're raising today? They'd be scrambling all the time to get enough, at least in their minds, to run what they consider a competitive campaign.
Well, they would be scrambling to raise money. They wouldn't be, you know, sitting on a telephone calling people asking for a $50 voucher. That's just not the way it would make sense for them to spend their time. So they would have to build campaigns that were responsive to what a vast majority of people in their district wanted in order to get their vouchers. Now, would it be a terrible thing if instead of them spending 80% of their time calling the tiniest fraction of the 1%, they were spending 50% of their time trying to persuade voters in their district that they, in fact, were the people that ought to be supported or that they were the candidate that ought to be supported in the next election? You know, I'm not sure it's a bad thing to have candidates trying to get people to support them. And what I think we could have is a system where they're not trying to get support just for one day, namely election day, but they're trying to gain support all through the election cycle, because of course they could be raising their voucher money at any time. And that would be a good thing. It would make them more responsive to their district, not more responsive to this tiny fraction of the 1% who fund campaigns today.
We're visiting with Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig. He's one of the speakers at this weekend's TEDxKC gathering of speakers presenting cutting-edge ideas. We're talking about campaign reform. So it sounds to me like, Professor, you're advocating that this notion that job one is to get out there and talk to the 91% of Americans who believe that nothing can be done and tell them, by George, yes, in fact, something can be done.
That's the first step. And then the second step is to say to them to do something, you know, to accept the responsibility of being a citizen, to step up and to force their representatives to deliver the democracy that we were promised, right? And the only way this is going to happen is if citizens do something about it. The politicians are too afraid to make change. They're too comfortable with the existing system. A lot of them make an extraordinary amount of money off the current system. And the only way we're going to get them to change it is if we force them to change it.
Talk to us about making an extraordinary amount of money through the system right now, because in your TED Talks, which I've watched a couple, you know, you actually talk about this notion of lawmakers becoming lobbyists and seeing their salaries quadruple. And that's one big disincentive against changing the system.
Yeah, I mean, one really sad fact about Washington right now is that Capitol Hill has become, as Congressman Jim Cooper, who has been in Congress he first went to Congress in 1983, Capitol Hill has become a kind of, quote, farm league for K Street, where the lobbyists work. And what he means by that is that members and staffers and bureaucrats have an increasingly common business model in their head, a business model focused not on their life in government, but their life after government, their life as lobbyists. So, you know, they go to Capitol Hill as a member of Congress for 6 to 8 years, and they want to cash out by becoming a lobbyist where they can make, you know, many times the amount of money that they made as a congressman. The same thing for staffers, maybe even worse for staffers, because, you know, the staffers have such enormous invisible power inside the system. And if they're focused on how to keep the lobbyists happy, then you know that that power is being exercised not in a way that's inconsistent with what the lobbyists want. Jack Abramoff, of course, you know, infamous former super lobbyist who was convicted of certain felonies related to his lobbying activity and has now become a kind of activist for reform. In his book, he writes about the most effective technique he had as a lobbyist. And what he said is, I would go into a Senate office, I would say to the chief of staff, so what are you doing in 2 years? And the chief of staff would say, well, Jack, I'm not sure yet. And Jack Abramoff would say, well, when you're finished, I want you to look me up.
Yeah.
And Abramoff says, you know, from that moment on, I owned that chief of staff, and not a single dollar had changed hands. And that's a dynamic that has become the norm inside of Washington. And that makes it very, very hard to get anybody inside of Washington to even think about the idea of changing the system. But, you know, ultimately they work for us. Ultimately, we can kick them out. We can vote in people who promise to make this kind of reform. And that's exactly what we should be doing.
Professor Lessig, you have a terrific phrase to describe just how dire the situation is out there. It's pathological, democracy-destroying corruption. That's a mouthful, but it's a pretty descriptive sense of what you see out there.
Yeah, it's each of those. It's pathological because it has really destroyed, corrupted the way the government is actually functioning. Democracy destroying because what it does is it convinces most people there's no reason for them to be even worried about what engaging in the political system because the political system is not responding to them. There's a great paper published this year by Martin Guilens and Ben Page, which was the largest empirical study of policy decisions, maybe in the history of political science, of the policy decisions of the United States government. And they were trying to see whether there was any relationship between what the average voter actually wanted and what our government actually did. And what they found is that there was no statistically significant relationship between what the average voter wants and what our government does. Instead, there's a pretty significant statistical relationship between what the elite contributors want or the business interests want and what our government did. And that's the reality of our democracy. It is not a democracy, and we have to do something to get it back.
Professor, I got 30 seconds left. Tell us about Root Strikers, the organization you founded in 2011 to change the influence of money in politics.
Well, Root Strikers was trying to raise awareness about this relationship, and I think we've done an enormous job. I don't think there's anybody out there who doubts this right now. The latest round of this is a super PAC we've started, really a super PAC to end all super PACs called Mayday.us. Mayday as in the distress call.
Yes.
And we've now raised close to $8 million. When that's matched, it'll be close to $13 million. To fund races, candidates in districts around the country who support reform, both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, as the first step to a campaign in 2016 where we will be trying to get a Congress committed to fundamental reform in the way campaigns are funded.
Again, that group is called Root Strikers. Our guest has been Professor Lawrence Lessig. He speaks this weekend as part of TEDxKC's gathering of speakers presenting cutting-edge ideas. Professor, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
No more questions, no more pain. I can give you all the answers. The things like hunger and poverty only exist because we never give.
Hawaii is bracing for an oncoming hurricane, but in Lawrence, one of the Aloha State's native daughters has become a force of nature all her own. Labeled as the one-woman band, Kavehi caught the attention of Esquire, The Huffington Post, and Elle when she posted the video of her cover of Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box earlier this year. Kavehi will be performing at Saturday's TEDxKC, but first she joins us here in the up-to-date studio, and what a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So good to have you. Well, listeners will be able to access that YouTube video through the up-to-date webpage, and they've got to see this. Just amazing. It's fascinating, not just for your amazing cover of the song, but also because you're showing your process of what you do on camera. The Huff Post noted that you did it all with a keyboard, a drum machine, and a glass of wine. Explain what you did to create all those layers of sound that we hear in that video.
I basically, you know, take a song and I strip it apart and I, you know, record live every single element of the song. So I don't have a drum set, so I do some beatboxing and then I do some, you know, keyboard sounds through Ableton and everything is recorded and just to build a whole entire piece of music.
And do you improvise when you do your take your show on the road around the country, or is it pretty much the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's always, I say it's 50-50, half improvisation and half, you know, you have to really kind of know what's going to go where and, you know, what sounds you'd use.
I mean, it's amazing to me that all that music comes from this little square box on the table next to you and a keyboard, and suddenly you've got a full band playing full blast here.
You know, that's the beauty of technology. Now you can do anything. I mean, the possibilities are, you know, endless. And I just, it's a really great way to create. And I'm so lucky I get to do that.
Why did you decide to go off on your own and become a one-woman band?
I started off as a singer-songwriter just with a guitar on stage, and I got really bored, and I wasn't getting any better, and I saw someone looping in Los Angeles, and I've always wanted to do it, and I've never really had any courage to do it, but, you know, I just got to that point where I wanted to get better and picked up the machine, and it's been my jam ever since.
How difficult is it to do what you do?
It's rough. It's definitely...
You made it look easy in the video, which is working against you here right
That's
now.
That's the wine. That's where the wine comes in.
Good idea. But it is tough.
It is. Hours and hours and, you know, of practice, just being able to punch in and punch out on the right time. I think that's the most difficult thing, especially live on stage where, you know, there's nerves and there's different sound systems. You definitely have to have a really good sense of time.
Huh. How similar is what we just heard to how you created the song we heard at the start of this interview, Anthem, which is on your current EP, Robot Heart?
It's incredibly, I mean, I do that song live. That's what it sounds like. All of the, you know, it's all vocal sounds. So the beatboxing's on me. The bass is, you know, it's my voice through an octifier. So it sounds really nice and low, like a bass sound. I mean, everything, you know, my records sound pretty much, you know, like what it sounds like live. So I like to do that, keep it that way.
And your songs typically sort of incorporate, start slowly, then you're adding layer upon layer until you're building to a full crescendo kind of sound. Is that what we can expect to hear from you?
Yes. Most of my songs start off that way and sound that way, especially live. You know, you'll see me because I lay each part down, you know, right in front of you, and I create it right in front of you. So yeah, that's pretty much the way it goes.
How do you write your music? Where do you get your ideas?
A lot of them are through Kickstarter pledges. I do these projects to fund my EPs. And a lot of them, I'll turn to the fans and ask them, you know, what do you think my song should be, you know, the EP should be about this time? And, you know, it's a really great way to write about different issues and different, you know, things that people are thinking about right now.
Kavahi, why did you think that Kickstarter would be an avenue for you to do what you do?
Well, I wanted to stay independent, and, you know, I didn't want to sign on with a record label, and that's why.
Why not?
Because I like to keep it, you know, DIY. After Heart Shaped Box went viral, it's a little more difficult to, you know, instead of keeping track of like 1,000 fans, now I have like 100,000 fans. So it's a little harder, but I like to keep that creative control. And you know, I don't have any intentions to be, you know, a big, huge next Taylor Swift. I like to do the kind of music I like to do. I like to keep it small, and Kickstarter is a great way to do that.
Why not become the next Taylor Swift? What's so bad about that?
I think it's great if you want to be a big rock star, but that's not why I do it. I do it because it's my passion. I love to make music, and, you know, hopefully along the way I gain some people who enjoy it too.
We're visiting with Kavahi, who's in town this week for the TEDx KC conference. That's a conference of cutting-edge ideas taking place at the Kauffman Center on Saturday. I have to ask, what was it about Lawrence that made you want to set up shop there? I mean, why Lawrence, Kansas, of all places? You're from Hawaii.
I'm from Hawaii.
And how did you make your way out here?
Well, my husband, actually, he found just online the studio. We were looking to move from Los Angeles. I lived there for 10 years, moving from Hawaii, and I was really tired of living out there. And, you know, it was really expensive. So we were looking, I was thinking more of, you know, like the Pacific Northwest, but he randomly found this recording studio. And I asked him, I said, can we work there if we move there tomorrow? And he said, yep. So I literally did not see, you know, Lawrence, Kansas, or the new home we lived in until we showed up with the U-Haul. Trust. That's a lot of trust.
That's a leap of faith, girl. That's a huge leap of faith.
I know.
The studio is not in Lawrence. It's in Eudora, which is just to the east of Lawrence. Describe it to me. What is it, and where is it, and how does it work?
It's the oldest building. It was built like almost 200 years ago, and it used to be an old general store. It's like a huge, you know, 7,500 square foot brick building that they converted to a recording studio.
And you guys bought it, do I understand?
We bought it. Mm-hmm. We bought the studio and we moved in, and you know, I mean, there's like a lived loft place upstairs, and you could just kind of like crash pad and just a couple of, you know, recording studios underneath.
Is it a place that's really conducive to helping you do what you want to do?
It definitely is. You know, it's just such a big space and, you know, tons of possibilities. And the building's beautiful. And we've shot Heart Shaped Box there. And pretty much a lot of videos that we've done have been shot at the, you know, in different rooms in the big building. So it's a great spot.
Yeah, I want to go back to the Nirvana video. And again, I can't urge our listeners enough. If you want to see something amazing, go to kcur.org, find the up-to-date page, and click on this YouTube video, because chances are you'll become a fan pretty quickly. You shot that, was it just one take? And tell me it was like 95 takes.
No, it was just one take. And I mean, I struggle watching it because I see a lot of mistakes, you know, because
really?
It was really just a turn. Hey, let's, I remember the day we were waiting for the pizza to come because we had ordered pizza. Already, like, you can see the bottle of wine is like halfway done because I had already started into it. And, you know, it was just like, my husband got new cameras. I got a new piece of gear, and I was going down to South by Southwest for, you know, to play a bunch of shows. And I was like, okay, I got to practice. He's like, okay, I got to use these cameras. And that was it. That was the whole thing.
You set it up and let it rip.
Let it rip. Yep.
And you are traveling the world these days. Where have you been?
I've been to Sweden. I've been throughout the U.S. We just came off of like a East Coast, West Coast tour. We're going to Brazil. We're going to Asia in October. So it's, I mean, I'm pretty much after this one video, it's just kind of exploded. And I mean, I'm really grateful.
That's so exciting. Is there a message behind what you do that people can do more by themselves than they think they can? Or am I reaching too far here?
No, that's exactly what, you know, I mean, I tell people, find out what you love to do and just do it. You don't need that much help. You just need drive and just a really good fan base, and the possibilities are endless.
It's been a pleasure to meet you.
You too.
Wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. I love the video.
I really did. Kaveh, he performs this weekend at the TEDxKC event. Thanks so much for coming in today, and best of luck with the new EP. Let's play the title track as we head into break, and here we go. Kaveh.
Get beat.